Welcome to The Urban Complex, a system of interrelated, emotion-charged ideas, feelings, memories, and impulses. This name takes the definition and lays out what a listener should expect. A podcast where ideas, feelings, and memories collide, leading towards meaningful change. I'm co-host Chris Richardson. Please enjoy the journey with The Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
All opinions by Chris Richardson, Dominic Papa, and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Arizona State University or the Arizona Commerce Authority. Any endorsement of or messages from sponsors are solely supporting the production of this podcast. There is no relationship further than podcast purposes with any sponsor unless separately created with another entity.
Hey, Chris, how's it going?
Pretty good. You know, I'm sitting here kind of smiling because we've always talked, you know, since our introduction, we had these types of our audience, whether they're guests or contributors or influencers or boundary spanners. And, you know, we've talked about how, you know, you see people commenting on social, that's starting to ramp up. That's exciting. I always like to see that, you know, following us, sharing us, like us. But what's really interesting is when our own audience, those that are true champions, are the ones bringing us the guests. And that's what happened here. You know, we always ask the guests who you should have on, but here one of our super fans, Angelica, who I believe you met, I think I introduced you to her Meeting of the Minds back in February of 20. She's a ASU sustainability, works for our School for Futures intern. And she's like, you got to meet this guy, Ron Ghani. He's doing all sorts of cool stuff. He worked at New York City, and now he's got this fund. You got to meet him. You're going to love it. And, you know, sure enough, here he is at the show. And I just love that came from a guest. They sent us a note, and it turns out it's a great recommendation. We got a few of those others as well. So I don't know, that's why I'm pumped.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I think we need more of that. So excited to engage more with our listeners, our audience, and bring us those ideas, bring us those guests that we need to speak to, because I think there's just too many good stories out there we need to tell. I know I'm loving the fact that now on conference circuits or on panels, the podcast and what's been talked about is starting to come up in my...
Yeah, it's starting to get some buzz. It's been fun.
Yeah, so it's fun. So yeah, excited to have Ron. Should we bring him in?
Yeah, so Ron Ghani, let's do it.
Yep, here we go.
Support for this episode of The Urban Complex comes from Worldwide Technology.
What if we could connect people to new possibilities, turn thinking into a way forward, solve problems before they become a problem, and share the future with everyone? We can. At WWT, we connect businesses to technology to make the impossible possible, to reach better decisions faster, to accelerate progress. Together, let's make a new world happen.
All right, Ron. Well, please let Dom and I give you a warm welcome to the podcast, The Urban Complex.
Thank you, guys. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining. Cool. So we have just found that one of the best ways for our guests to get acquainted with our audience is to talk about themselves and kind of how you got to where you are, right? And we'll get to all the great things you're doing currently. But yeah, just you know, tell us about you. Make sure to highlight New York City. We're a smart city focus. So be great to know you.
Sure. So spent the first part of my life in Israel and then moved to the U.S. where I grew up in Philadelphia. And what was interesting about cities and growing up in Philadelphia in the 80s and early 90s was that was a rough time for Philadelphia. And so I got a firsthand experience around things not working from an urban perspective. And I think actually a lot of what you're seeing today in terms of prison reform, drug reform, you know, those were the types of policies that I actually saw destroy Philadelphia and neighborhoods. But I grew up in Philadelphia and had the good fortune of my first kind of real job was working for a family, kind of doing odds and ends, babysitting, fixing stuff, this and that. And the dad was actually one of the first green architects in America. And so that's actually where I got introduced to this concept of sustainable building. And I remember when he was...
He's like, don't throw that away, recycle that.
That's right. That's right. Or like, hey, if you just, you know, use these kind of windows or angle the house this way. But, the thing I remember most is how intuitively that made great sense to me, while at the same time, how much criticism and people looking askance at him, he was the recipient of for these ideas that he had. And just in my young high school mind, I was like, something's not right here. What he's talking about makes sense, but society is trying to push back and the industry is trying to push back. Like, that's interesting. Why is that going on? But that's where I got my start in terms of sustainable business practices way back when. So sometimes people will say to me, wow, you know, your ideas are so timely, or, you know, you seem to like know exactly what you're
35, 40 years in the making, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like a 30 year overnight success. Like, I've been thinking about this stuff for a long time and was really fortunate to be exposed to it early on. And I've been working in the space for a long time. It's really wonderful to now see all this galvanizing together. But fast forward, when I graduated college, it was sort of the dot-com boom in the late 90s. And I ended up going to work at what is now Accenture, then Anderson Consulting. And that was a great experience because it taught me a lot about software development and business process and engineering. And while there were times while I was there where I was kind of thinking to myself, why am I doing this? What am I doing here? I'm just coding C++ and Siebel systems. And how's this helping me in life or my interest in social causes? But looking back on it, it was invaluable. I got foundational understanding of how business process works, software works, hardware works, so on and so forth. But in my late 20s, I realized my real interest was at this intersection between social policy, the environment, and business. And I believed that the best way to maximize returns was by focusing on transparent business practices that aligned stakeholders' interest. And so I went back to business school in 2002. And what was interesting is that when I got to Columbia Business School, where I got my MBA, and people would say, well, what are you going to do when you graduate with a Columbia Business School MBA? I said, well, I'm going to focus on building a company at the intersection of progressive social policy and maximizing returns. It's
like, wait a second. You're supposed to maximize shareholder value, Ron.
Yeah, it was like silence in the room. And it was like, people were like, oh, okay, but how are you going to pay off your loans if you do that? Right? It was like, I don't understand. Like, are you like, what family do you come from? Maybe you're just, I'm like, I grew up with a single mom and, you know, kind of lower middle class neighborhood in Philly. They're like further dumbfounded, being like, what? Like, I don't understand. Like, how do you, this is a business school. But lo and behold, I started my first recycling company at Columbia. Yeah. Columbia was my first investor.
Oh, well.
Wow.
And
did you know Michael Crow at the time? He was at Columbia.
No. And, they invested the first $100,000 in my first business and actually exited a few years later with $1.5 million. Wow. So it was
instrumental. That was their return.
That was their return. Yeah, it was instrumental to me because at the time when I was trying to raise money for my first company, Recycle Bank, I was getting no traction. And they put the first $100,000 in and then ended up building a moderately successful recycling company. And they got a great return, but I couldn't have gotten my career trajectory off without that first 100K from,
that's amazing.
From Columbia. And so then I ran my first recycling company, Recycle Bank, as a CEO from 2003 to 2010. And then I exited and then started a small solar business, went back to Columbia and started teaching. So
is that when did you start the business 2010 when all the money from the Obama era was really funding green startups?
No. So interestingly, what I always tell people about the Recycle Bank experience, my first experience, I actually built the business during the Bush administration. So 2003, 2010. And I would oftentimes in presentations tell people like, this is a good example of how resilient my business is we're growing under the Bush administration. And so if we ever got a Democratic administration in there, well, we'd really take off. Unfortunately, I ended up leaving before, Obama came into office.
We just had a guest representing Civ Labs in New York, and they just benefited from that same era of money. I was just curious if that was what was fueling some of your stuff. Cool. So how did you get to the city?
After my Recycle Bank experience, I was working on the solar company. I was teaching at Columbia and trying to think about, like, how do I find that next thing that gave me as much passion as Recycle Bank? And the mayor, Bloomberg, and the deputy mayor, someone named Cass Holloway, and this is really, credit to Cass, were looking around at how waste was managed in the city. They're saying, we're spending almost $400 million a year exporting waste out of state landfills. New York City doesn't have a landfill. And we send some of our waste to New Jersey to be incinerated, and the rest goes to landfills in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and South Carolina. So when you're stuck on the highway thinking, like, hey, it's all right that I'm stuck on I-95, all these trucks, it's American commerce, and there's a strong possibility it's just New York City's garbage that you're sitting behind. And so Cass, the deputy mayor, was looking around going, this is insane. Like, I can't believe we're spending $400 million a year exporting all this waste out of the city. We've got local recycling companies. We got to completely shift this model. Talked about it with Mayor Bloomberg, and Mayor Bloomberg, he's a businessman at his heart. Mm-hmm. And I said, absolutely, let's figure out how to do it. And so I ended up getting recruited to come in to reimagine and rebuild the city sanitation department. And it was a very special opportunity for me because I was really at a point in my life where I was struggling emotionally, because I wasn't sure how I was going to recapture that same energy and that same passion that I had in building my first business. And I was fortunate that I'd had a modest exit, so I had a little bit of time to think about what I wanted to do next in life. But I really wanted to find that next thing that I was just incredibly passionate about. And I couldn't find it. And it was bringing me down. And then I got the call from the city, and I got to go in and rebuild.
Put me in, coach.
Yeah. I was like, I can do this. I really had no idea what I was getting myself into, but I was like, I can do this. And I was kind of like the compromise candidate, I often tell people, because the environmentalists were all over Bloomberg because of the way the sanitation department was operating, just sending all the stuff to landfill. But at the same time, he knew that this was an old school, sanitation department.
Literally. Like, I'm thinking,
old school, but, real old school. And so he also knew that, hey, stuff's at the end of the day, it's got to get picked up. And so he needed to bring somebody in that the rank and file respected, a garbage man, so to speak. And I had this kind of combination of being known as a very progressive, very focused on the environment advocate in New York City, while at the same time, the sanitation guys knew me as a guy who, like, started a recycling business. I have a bunch of patents on hydraulics and how things work on sanitation vehicles. So I was also known as, this guy who, built a recycling company and optimized hydraulics on recycling vehicles. So I was courting this, compromise candidates between the two sides. But it was a phenomenal opportunity to come into the city I live in and love and try to have an impact.
Well, cool. So thanks for that. So what's Closed Loop Partners? I mean, that's what you're doing now. And it sounds like it's in the sweet spot of where you want to be, given the story.
Sure. So while I was in the mayor's office, I was thinking about, well, after I get done this experience, what would I do next? One of the interesting things about joining an administration where you're a political appointee is the day you start, you actually know what your last day on the job is going to be. Right. So you're kind of like, in a sort of 6 months left in the administration, you start kind of thinking about, what do I want to do next? And so one of the things that I'd become interested in was how the products that we use are manufactured. Because going back to that high school experience of being with somebody who was looking at the built environment and saying, this actually isn't the most efficient way to build, that becoming infused as part of my DNA. And being involved in the recycling industry where I was handling all these products and packaging, I started thinking about how are all these products and packages manufactured? I started looking at that system and saying, well, this is interesting. Most of this is manufactured using extractive resources, So for plastic, you got to extract oil. Metal, you got to extract ore. Paper, you got to extract timber. It's designed to be used once in a product and then to be discarded in a landfill. And then you start that process all over again. And I thought to myself, like, man, that cannot have been designed to be the optimal system. Somebody must be making a buck there. It shouldn't be making a buck.
Yeah.
And what I found was not only were they making a buck, they were making billions of bucks. And that's really the extractive resources, the oil and gas and mining industry had really gamed our system starting in the 1950s and the landfill industry to force us to participate in the system where all the products and packages that we use come from virgin resources and are designed in products and packages that we're supposed to just use once and then throw in a landfill. So I started thinking about, okay, well, how do you fix that system? And started looking at a circular economy model where you look at material science, you look at product design, you look at advanced manufacturing, advanced recycling systems, and you think about how can we design a product without the need for natural resource extraction or disposal on landfill. And then you start looking at the cost of that extractive resource and the cost of landfill, and you realize, wow, we can manufacture this material for far less money. Mm. You end up saving consumer goods companies money, retailers money, consumers money, taxpayers money. And so that was the genesis behind this idea of building an investment firm that would focus on the circular economy. And I started talking to some of the large retailers and consumer goods companies that I had a relationship with. And interestingly, they said, we've been thinking about the same thing, but we don't really have a model as to how to build out the circular economy. And that became the genesis of what today is Closed Loop Partners, which is an investment firm focused on building out the circular economy.
Awesome. Ron, that's an incredible background. I just love how you continued to identify a challenge or a problem and then figure out a way to go solve it. Awesome, awesome background. Thanks for sharing it with us. You know, we've had a lot of fun on this podcast. It is a smart city podcast. Our theme is kind of smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow. So what we've loved to do is kind of ask our guests their own view of smart cities, because as we know, there's no one good definition for it. But we'd love to hear your view on smart cities, and especially how does sanitation, recycling, and sustainability play into that view? And in your mind, what's worked, what hasn't? You know, we're always curious to understand from our guest perspective.
Well, I think a smart city is a livable city.
Mm.
And if you think about what makes a city livable, what makes a city livable is access to affordable housing. And I don't mean affordable housing like it's got to be cheap or low income housing. I just mean it's got to be affordable where people aren't forced to live in super tiny spaces. So affordable and decent housing, access to green space. We're human beings. We evolved to be in nature. Now, our economies have also developed in such a way where we need to be in close proximity. So that's a good thing. A lot of growth has come from that. But we need to find a way to merge the two, where you can live in a city in close proximity to where you work and the people you want to be around, while also having access to green space. So that's an important one. I think being able to get around in a leisurely way where you're not stuck in a car. I think that's another interesting study in US history, where the transportation nodes were not necessarily built in the best interest of the citizen taxpayer. It was built in the best interest of the automotive industry. If you ask most people, would you rather get on a high-speed train or a subway or ride a bicycle in a safe bike lane to work, or sit in a car in traffic for an hour, which would you prefer?
Yeah, exactly.
Most people are going to prefer high-speed rail, subway, metro, ride my bike in a safe bike lane. But where have our tax dollars gone? Our tax dollars have actually gone to build highways and roads. The amount of space taken up by parking spots in US cities is gargantuan. So that's another thing that's really important, is how you enable people to get around in a leisurely and healthy way. And then you have things like safe streets. Obviously, you want to make sure that crime is low and people feel safe. And then when it comes to your waste and recycling, making sure that you're not paying to export items that were used in your city to a landfill. That's just a poor use of taxpayer dollar. How do you set up a system where you can reuse a lot of materials or packaging? And whatever you can't reuse, that you're able to recycle it locally, put it back into a local manufacturing system. Sounds great for the environment, which it is, but it's also a great way to significantly reduce your tax dollars.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a perfect segue to kind of dive deeper into some of those successes that you've had with closed loop partners with some cities. And especially, you know, we'd love to hear some of these success stories, but especially the one right here in our backyard in the city of Phoenix, but also, you know, I hear there's a really good one with the city of Ann Arbor, can you elaborate on maybe some of the successes you've had in particular those two cities?
Yeah, well, I'll give you successes on both ends of the spectrum, from innovation all the way to large scale. Perfect. So in terms of the city of Phoenix and also Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Quad Cities, Iowa, and Memphis, Tennessee, and a whole host of other cities, is we provided financing in the form of a loan in order for them to upgrade their recycling facilities, which would yield more recyclables, because there was a lot of recyclables that weren't getting into the right places. And then that loan is actually repaid through the commodity value that's generated from the facility. So it's a perfect example of everybody's winning on the side of the environment and the municipality. The municipality is able to extract more value from its recycling program, pay back the loan, and then that equipment is still there. So then it's just continuing to generate additional value. So that's on the large scale side, where Closed Loop Partners has been able to finance the upgrade to a number of recycling facilities to provide them with the most advanced equipment, increase their yield. On the innovation side, one company that I'll use as an example in terms of just how you could revolutionize how cities operate and people live, we have a portfolio company called Home Biogas. It's the first
home biogas.
Yeah, home biogas. It's the first household size anaerobic digester. So anaerobic digesters, for your listeners, convert anything organic, food waste, biological waste, into gas. You have these small enzymes that eat the biological waste or the organic waste and release gas, and you capture that gas, which is methane, and then you have gas. Yeah. And there's a number of large scale anaerobic digesters on dairy farms or in municipal cities at the wastewater treatment facilities, but no one's ever figured out a way to miniaturize it to an appliance for a household. And that's what Home Biogas has been able to do.
Awesome.
And so if you imagine Home Biogas being in every home in the city of Phoenix, you can now take all of your food waste, put it into your home biogas system, convert it to gas that you use for your barbecue or your hot water or your kitchen stove.
Are any cities actually trying to have that part of the city service so that it reduces what comes in?
So there's thousands of home biogas systems in operation around the world today, mostly
direct to consumer, right?
So far it's been direct to consumer in the US. In the emerging markets, it's direct to municipalities. And so there's a couple thousand systems in operation in the US direct to consumer. In Phoenix, there's a few homes that already have a home biogas system. We're in the process now of starting to work with municipalities around, let's get these installed in every home in the city that wants one, or every home that you want to have one, because 45% of what's in your garbage is organic material. If you take out your recyclables, your paper, metal, glass, and plastic, which is about 30% of your recycling stream, now what's left in your garbage is about 70 to 80% organic.
Well, my understanding is it's not just the volume, it's also the cost to clean the stuff that's contaminated because of the bio too. So you get kind of the double whammy.
Absolutely. And if somebody's doing a good job recycling their paper, metal, glass, and plastic, and your listeners can check this at home, if you're doing a good job recycling your paper, metal, glass, and plastic, you'll find that about 80, 90% of what you have left is food waste, soiled paper, so on and so forth. Today, the city has to send a truck to your home, and that truck is very expensive. The labor is expensive. The fuel is expensive. The maintenance is expensive. If they're picking it up to take it to the garbage, then they got to drive it over to a landfill and pay a fee. Hopefully, they're taking it to a compost facility if you have curbside organics collection, which a lot of cities have today. But you're still picking it up with a truck. You still got to drive it to a compost facility or AD facility, pay a tip fee. With home biogas, you can put this appliance in your backyard or attached to your home, put all of your food waste into it, converts it into gas for your home. So now the city doesn't have the cost anymore of having to come to your home to collect.
Or at least they can space it out maybe at a week, which changes the mechanics of the cost structure.
That's great. Or space it out. And then you also have homes that they're now generating enough gas to cook on every day, which is incredibly important for, you know, when you go down to the lower income level, you're now literally providing people the ability to not have to pay for gas for their cooking based on their food waste. But the other thing that you provide from a resiliency perspective is, and you know, we all know what just happened in Texas a couple of months ago where the grid went completely off. We know what happened with the Columbia pipeline on the East Coast where there was a virus attack on their software and they had to shut down the pipeline. So I think more and more American cities, more and more American households are becoming more aware of the importance of being energy resilient and energy independent. So this is another way, along with solar panels, where you can become energy resilient and energy independent.
Yeah, cool. So before we jump into the book you wrote, one more company that was stuck out to me, I'm curious the correlation. It was called Trade Lines. Seemed really interesting. And I was just thinking about it. It seemed to be like a trade shipping optimization. Yeah. And of course, we know kind of what you said, whether it's trying to get materials out like waste or just move product, it has probably tremendous impact on cities and the mechanics of cities. Tell us what Trade Lines is and how you think our audience of city-oriented individuals should be thinking about Trade Lines.
Yeah. So if you want to talk about an industry that's ripe for disruption and advanced technology, a lot of the shipping industry today is still paper and clipboard. And so what that means is that a lot of times you got the peaches sitting on the dock at 90 degree weather and the textbooks sitting in the warehouse in air conditioning, simply because nobody knows what's in this container. Right. So there's a huge amount of spoilage actually globally, simply because nobody's tracking where these containers are. Everything's literally still done on a clipboard and a piece of paper. And so Trade Lanes is digitizing seafaring commerce, where everything goes into a ledger. So when it's coming onto the dock, you can just scan it, see exactly what it is, where it came from, what temperature it needs to be held at. If it doesn't show up, you can see the last port that it was in. So Trade Lanes, the business we're very excited about, and a business that we think could significantly reduce loss in the shipping industry.
Gotcha. Okay, so when we first met, I think you had literally just received your first copy of your book that you wrote. I think you held it up. You literally took it out of the baggage. You're like, oh, I just wrote a book. And you held it up. I'm like, oh, cool. So tell our audience about the waste-free world. You know, why'd you write it? And kind of what's the intent you hope it'll have in impact as people read it or those principles get adopted?
Sure. So the Waste-Free World is a book about the history of how our manufacturing in the United States developed. And effectively, it's a story about a scam. It's a story about a hoax. It's a story about how we were marketed and pushed away from being a society that valued quality over quantity, valued being smart about our resources, to a society that in the 1950s shifted to one in which the way we measured our status was by just how much stuff we had. And if you look at marketing pre-1950, marketing pre-1950 was focused on, you know, the quality of a product, the durability of a product, that recycling was a patriotic duty. Mm-hmm. And post-World War II, there was a shift to really transition Americans to become a culture of just consumption and waste, because it fed the industrial complex of the extractive industries. The smarter we are as consumers, the smarter we are as taxpayers, the more resilient we are, the less money the extractive industries make, because there's less of a need for them to extract. And they were very sophisticated about lobbying and the federal government, state governments, using marketing agencies to change Americans' behavior to a way that actually wasn't in our best interest. And that's what the book is about. And then we talk about how to solve for that and all the great innovations that are coming out that can help us build a circular economy where we live a much more efficient lifestyle.
This one may put you on the spot. So as I'm hearing you think, you've clearly, as Dom said earlier, you've clearly had success at like recognizing a problem, but from this lens of a different way of looking at it. And you had a really solid response to smart cities. So maybe you have thought about this, maybe not. You might need a moment. But as we get to close to wrapping up, how do you think cities should be looking at their own problems? I mean, even something as simple as Trade Direct, you know, cities have not really digitized. So for instance, many cities haven't figured out the mechanics of a new model. Like how do you help them just think, all right, we can do it differently. We don't have to live by what we've inherited. Does anything come to mind? I think you uniquely solve these things and you're doing all sorts of cool stuff. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll use an example of Phoenix and the state of Arizona. I know you've got listeners all over the place, but since that's where you're based, we have to find a way to enable the local taxpayer to have more say in how their tax dollars are spent. An example I'll give you is the city of Phoenix should be the world leader in solar. It's got abundant sunshine. It's got top universities, and it's got a relatively higher income class that can easily afford to put solar panels on. So if you looked at the city of Phoenix, state of Arizona, you'd be like, these guys should never be paying for electricity or to charge their electric vehicle. It should just be solar on every home, solar car parks everywhere, so on and so forth. And that would be in the best interest of the citizen and the taxpayer. However, the big utilities in Arizona look at small scale distributed renewable energy solutions and say, wait a second, if that comes into play, what do we do? Mm-hmm. And so they start to fire up their government affairs and start to figure out what politicians they gotta start to get behind to make sure that small scale distributed renewable energy solutions are blocked and made more expensive, and that the average household doesn't have access to it. It's about as anti-capitalist as you can get, right? What we should be saying in Arizona is, here are all your choices. Free market. You taxpayer, you decide what you want for your home, but you also decide where your aggregate tax dollars should go. Should it go to fund utilities? Should it go to bring down the cost of solar because we can do a aggregate buy for the community?
And if you get folks on board early, they can literally be recreating their business model and or investing in the same startups to hedge that then might disrupt them.
Yeah.
Because when you allow industry to thrive, I mean, one thing Arizona has done amazingly well, and Dom's very close to this, is creating an environment for other areas of entrepreneurism. I mean, in terms of driverless cars, in terms of chip semiconductor manufacturing, I mean, our government, Governor Ducey, consciously constructed these ecosystems of ability to pilot. So that's really, really interesting way to look at it. So what do you think, I'll ask one more kind of off the cuff question here. Like, what do you think limits it? Do you think it is the lobbying, or do you think it's the taking the risk, or do you think it's the complexity of, because it is complicated to completely change models. How do you see that work?
Yeah, I think it's entrenched interests matched with a campaign finance structure that doesn't work in the best interest of the citizen taxpayer. And by the way, I don't fault the entrenched interests. I understand what they're doing. They're operating their own self-interest. They're saying, we're this big, massive, centralized utility. We want to keep our jobs. We want to survive. So I understand why they're doing what they're doing. What we have to make sure of is the system says, hey, you're welcome to try to maintain your legacy antiquated system. It's a free market. You're welcome to do that. But you're not welcome to provide funding to elected officials to try to get them to side with you.
Right.
Because you have way more capital, way more access than the individual citizen does. And it takes a lot more work for all these individual citizens to galvanize together, pull their money together, and compete with you. But at the end of the day, what that elected official needs to be focused on is that individual taxpayer. And so I think Arizona has this weird situation going of really good innovation over the last decade, while at the same time, some entrenched interest that won't let go. And in order to really get the full potential out of that innovation, you have to have a regulatory and policy apparatus that allows for the best solution to win out, not who's been
there. And that is an area, I mean, Don, you can probably speak to this. There is some investment in really cutting edge policy. I don't know if you want to share, but.
No, yeah. I mean, I think as Chris mentioned, you know, just our focus on what are those disruptive industries that we can really get behind at an early stage to really drive forward. As Chris mentioned, autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles,
yeah,
electric vehicles. I mean, now all of a sudden, everyone's saying the desert's going green because we've become this EV manufacturing hub all of a sudden. And you're starting to see the perceptions and the thoughts and the ideas start to change. It's been slow, but at least you're starting to see it click, right? So it's been fun.
Sounds like we should plug Ron into some folks at the state. I know ASU, our school sustainability, we got ranked number one in the United States, third in the nation, third in the world. So there's probably some ways to connect to kind of accelerate things. Be great. Cool.
I think it's important to work backwards for a state and say, 10 years from now, if we go down this path of renewable energy and sustainability, how many jobs are going to be created versus the kind of antiquated system we have right now? So let's look 5-10 years forward. And whichever one shows that if we allowed the free market to operate, would create more jobs, we should, as a state.
And by the way, we can cut costs to the taxpayer. Yeah. And by the way, we can cut costs to the city at the same time as creating jobs. It's a win-win.
Yeah. How do we accelerate that? So that's, I think combining innovation with the right policy to support that innovation is really important in cities, because unfortunately there's a lot of entrenched interests that are oftentimes utilizing policy to maintain their antiquated system and clamp down. And that's the thing that I think is most important in terms of helping cities.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we could ask you questions. There's more. We'll have to get you back when we have and you've had some more wins under your belt. Sounds like there's plenty of things you're seeding. We do have one standard question. I know for Dom and I, we've realized that we can't do things on our own. And curious who you may want to appreciate at the same time. Think about that. Who might be someone that would be a great guest on the show to engage our audience of, you know, mayors, CIOs, CTOs, city managers, and so on. I know we're appreciative, at least I am. Angelica introduced us, or I wouldn't have known you. So I don't know. Anyone come to mind on who should have on the urban complex, or who's really helped make you with your break?
Sure. So a really good guest would probably be someone named John Shaharian. He's the CEO of ERI, Electronic Recyclers International. Hmm. It's the largest electronics recycler in the US. Really dynamic guy. So just fun guy to have as a guest, but I think also an interesting topic for your listeners, because there's just so much electronics out there. And on one hand, it can become an environmental disaster because it's got mercury in it and all kinds of stuff that you got to be careful of. On the other hand, huge business opportunity, huge business opportunity. So, so he'd be one that I'd suggest.
Great.
I'd introduce you.
Oh yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, Ron, with that, the Urban Complex gives a big note of thanks to today's guest, Ron Gonin, founder and CEO of Closed Loop Partner and author of The Waste-Free World and former NYC Deputy Commissioner of Sanitation, Recycling, and Sustainability. Whew, got all that out in one. Thanks for joining us, Ron. It's been a blast. Thanks, Ron.
Glad to be with you guys today.
All right, Dom. Well, that was Ron Gonin. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, great guy to talk to. What an incredible leader. What a kind of an incredible journey in a space that is just now coming to fruition. As you mentioned, he's a 30 plus year veteran of this, but this whole kind of renewable, smart recycling, smart waste has really come to the forefront right now, which is an exciting time. And, you know, I want to hit on this idea of, it seems, again, we had another kind of individual with a management consultant background who's transitioned from that management consulting role into like a role that is either working within cities as he did with New York, or now working from the outside in, continuously helping to reimagine what innovation in cities means. And I think that's just a interesting discussion, because sometimes, you know, when you're in the city and you've been working for the city for a long time, it's hard to think outside the box. And sometimes individuals like Ron, who you can bring in like Bloomberg did, to kind of reimagine how waste in New York could be led. I think it's just an interesting idea of when our listeners are thinking about starting their own smart city journey and who again to hire. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, you don't have to just go with the traditional person that's done 20 plus years in cities. You can find expertise to kind of really shake it up. I think you're spot on. And we've seen a lot of that with our guests. We've had finance backgrounds. We've had, you know, consulting, as you say. We have people that have been lawyers. So it's just interesting to hear the journey. It's always fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just love bringing in a new mindset. You could just tell how, I think I mentioned it during the interview, but you could see how his mind works. Like, there's a process over there. Something seems off about that process. Something's not right. There's inefficiency. There's a challenge to be solved. Let me go figure it out. Right. And how he's just this inquisitive.
I mean, we told him like two questions we were going to ask, and we threw some softballs that we knew he'd be able to answer. But then, like, I asked him something, I just could tell he'd be able to think that way. When I asked him, well, what would you do if you were a city? And he just picked it related to where we live. And it really resonates, and it shows why it's hard to do these things. You're right. I mean, he does have that mind. And, you know, it's finding that person that can be the catalyst to look at something differently and get the ball rolling when the initial part is hard. But then once it's going and you've got the you know, I was just telling a colleague the other day about what it means to be a thought leader, is you have to see something that doesn't really exist. Parts of it may, but to pull it together where a business case is made, where it actually gets the impetus to drive the change, that's when you are really doing something. And then when the ball rolls downhill, it's like a lot easier. And I think he's done that a few times, you know?
Well, yeah, I know. It's just going to be interesting to see his future here. I mean, he is in an emerging space that is coming to fruition right now, especially with the administration and the focus on kind of green tech, green energy, renewable energy. He made a very, I think, poignant comment around, even though there's a lot of hype, we still need smart policy. I mean, he's talked about that idea of, you know, inserting the home bio technology in every home. I mean, it makes sense, right? It makes sense if low-income households that can't even afford their rent and their gas payment, if they just had this in their home, that's removing one bill from their home and providing them with enough gas to live and work on, right? But it's going to be hard for cities to just kind of put this in building code, all right, or just implement this policy at scale, because it's just difficult. But I think you'll start to see cities start to chip away and other cities will learn. And then you'll start to see kind of mass scale rollout of these technologies that get implemented through smart policy, because the tech seems there, it's proven, it works.
Yeah. Right?
But it's the policy that's kind of holding it back.
Yeah. You know, that home biogas was a really interesting example of that, right? Where, you know, there's this product out there. It clearly converts solid waste into some other form. So it takes stuff out of the trash. It actually converts it into an energy that's usable. And I asked that question. So where is the market? Is it direct to consumer or is it the municipality? Well, it's hard to get the policy in place to shift an entire model to do that right away. So they're doing direct to consumer now, but other markets that don't have that same sort of infrastructure, you know, instead of emerging markets, they're kind of going at the municipality level. But imagine maybe they went over some small city, get it started, or some subset of a city, demonstrate it out. It's kind of like we've heard a lot of our guests, pilot something, think big, start small, pilot something, see if it really does it. And then you find a way to scale it and you change stuff over time. I think people think they have to have the 5 to 10 year plan and everything figured out. But if you just know the first step, you get going. So it's a great point.
I just think it's interesting. It's this in smart cities, you always see this kind of, it's the Steve Case model, the rise of the rest, right? Because someone jumps out ahead and gets really, really ahead in a certain sector, but then they get too big to move and can't be innovative. But then the next ones take that next leap forward, right? And it's just continuing to like play this leapfrog game. So I think you're exactly.
Yeah, but at least, but they're collegial too. So they'll share what's working and what's not, because it's like benefiting everyone. It's a great model.
What do you think about
I think another piece that I saw that might not have came across was when we asked about that company Trade Lines, I didn't really understand what it was. I thought there was going to talk about more transportation, which is really important for cities. But when he brought it back to that, it was a clipboard and paper process. I guess so much of our industries out there today that they just expect people just, well, that's the process. That's how it works, right? But if you pull back the covers and you see, wait, we can redo this and start working backwards as he referenced. Like there's we started this relationship with transportation. I guess all the bus providers out here do the same thing. They have this clipboard and paper process of doing some data. And if we could automate that, imagine then all of a sudden you could have this completely transformative way that all of our metro is operating. I don't know. I just think it's important for our listeners to realize that sometimes if it's paper and clipboard, just because it's effective, doesn't mean it's optimal.
Exactly. And I just think if you're an entrepreneur out there, if you're someone like Ron, there's so much room for innovation. Same thing I hear from my job at the Commerce Authority happens down at our border. Trucks have to wait in line. Produce trucks have to wait in line because the process is so manual.
Yeah, good point.
You get spoilage and you lose ton of produce. And that's produce that, you know, becomes waste. So I just think, it opens a lot of doors for entrepreneurs like ourselves and like Ron to innovate. But again, it takes the right kind of leaders within the organizations to be amenable to it. What else? Anything else that stuck out for you before we move to cracks?
Well, there's plenty. But I think we should jump to cracks in payment.
Let's do it. What do you got for us?
Well, I was starting to get a little nervous that you're getting all the good ideas lately. So I really put some time in this time. And it just so happens, as Ron referenced parking today when he was talking about what needs to be a smart city, that's very, very, very timely. There's an Atlantic article that came out in May, how parking destroys cities. And I think it was interesting. He didn't jump into it too deep, other than the space taken could be used from something else. But what I thought was interesting from the article, as I'm scrolling down here really quick, is that there's kind of two things that parking does. First of all, it's supposed to take folks away from using the curb and deviate to where they want people to park so that traffic can flow. Well, you know, human nature, if there's parking available on the curb, they're going to go there first. So it actually doesn't solve that. I know there's some interesting technologies out there to optimize the curb. We also heard about the LA Metro folks where they're actually using the photos to get people that are in the bus lanes at the curb off there. So I think that's kind of funny. And then the other piece, which I think Ron talked about in other parts of his conversation, is about how the industry sets up a norm. Because parking is so central to cities, it's actually designing to have more cars come. So you get this, if it's designed to park and there's parking and it's convenient, then it actually doesn't kind of incentivize to reduce the car complexity. And that's why, you know, we've talked about before, the EV, electronic vehicle, and the autonomous vehicle, like we're on the precipice of completely changing all that model. It's really exciting. And I just think, what was it called? I think it's called the Air Garage. Two students, I shouldn't call them kids, came out of ASU. They started this Air Garage. They moved to the Bay Area because it's gone super successful. It's like you're turning your garage into a parking spot, or you turn in your driveway into a parking spot. And so there's just really some creativity coming, just like we mentioned earlier. Yeah. It's a time where anything can be reimagined. Parking should be one.
Yep, exactly. Chris, you just gave a spotlight. Air Garage was actually the first winner of the IDP Smart City App Hack with Bill Gates way back when.
Really? Those guys were so cool. And that idea, we'll have to check in and see how they're doing. I know they moved out there and, parking has not settled. So,
well, and so you're telling me parking's like the Kevin Costner. If you build it in the city, it will come.
It's probably right. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this just gets into everything we've been talking about with all of our guests and the way cities are going to need to be reimagined in the next 5 to 10 years. You know, it's going to be incredible to see what sort of infrastructure and urban aspects change due to the onslaught of technology, not just, parking, but things like Ron said,
you just got me thinking, as you said, the Kevin Costner, if you build it, they will come. The flip side is think about the risk if you don't build parking in about how, what if people don't want to do that? And that's the risk taking. Like, it makes me think of cul-de-sac and how they had to go and get rid of the permits for the first time at such a large facility, 17 acres, to not have parking on there. I mean, to take the risk and do something different to get a different return, it's scary.
I mean, every city wants a vibrant, livable downtown, right? You want people to come shop, go to games. I mean, I've been a culprit of it before. Like, oh, let's go to downtown Phoenix. Oh, wait, it's so hard to park down there.
You get rid of parking, you turn it into outdoor dining. You can turn it into something with canopy cover in here in the desert. So there's all sorts of things that could happen if we could get back to 50% of parking
space. Oh, and I think that's a good maybe way to end this. It's like what Ron said, very short, very succinct. What's a smart city? It's a livable city, right? So I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah. Right on. All right. Well, thanks all. Good to see you.
Yep. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Urban Complex, smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow. Please find us on where you listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. We do love your feedback. Let us know if you have ideas for guests or questions to air on Cracks in the Pavement via social media. The Urban Complex is found on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Or just shoot me an email. Chris@theurbancomplex.com. Till next time.